Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. My guest on today's morning show is Susan Bordo, a feminist scholar and media critic whose previous book, Unbearable Weight, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She is a professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky, and has been a longtime supporter of Hillary Clinton, and offers analysis of Mrs. Clinton's shocking loss in November in a very interesting new book titled The Destruction of Hillary Clinton. You are, in a sense, roughly part of Hillary Clinton's generation. That is, you would identify more with the generation of feminists with Hillary Clinton than you would, for instance, with millennial feminists.
Right.
And you talk at some length about that divide. But on the other hand, you say at one point early in the book, on the face of it, my biography and Hillary Clinton's could not look more different. I wonder if you could just spend a moment clarifying, in a sense, the common ground that you share with Hillary Clinton, but on the other hand, the ways in which your respective personal biographies are actually quite distinct from each other.
That's a very interesting question. You're the first one to ask me that, and I'm happy to address it. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and very much my background, very similar to Bernie Sanders, in fact. You know, working class, Jewish. My father was barely born in this country. My mother immigrated from Poland. I was very much into leftist politics, but I was also shaped powerfully by expectations about women during that period. And that's the part that Hillary and I share. I mean, Hillary, you know, she's a Methodist, I'm a Jew, she was solidly middle class, I'm working class. I was a college dropout. I dropped out of college twice. Hillary went very smoothly, you know, throughout the first part of her life, greatly encouraged. And I believe that, although, of course, she must have faced sexism when she was young, as we all did, I think she only really began to confront it at a later stage of her life, when she became more of a public figure. So we had, you know, we had a very different background as children in terms of our economic class, religion, etc. What we shared was the larger cultural context in which women were going through this profound transition. This is something that begins to happen when we are teenagers, largely, from what Betty Friedan called the feminine mystique. You know, this notion that the ideal woman was that she critiques, of course, the ideal woman as presented in magazines was someone who stayed at home cooking tasty casseroles that took her all day to make, did not have a job, spent a great deal of time thinking about decorating her house. Of course, it was a very white middle class idea, and we saw it represented on TV all the time, you know, in shows like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best. And Hillary and I grew up within a culture in which that was the dominant idea. However, by mid-60s, that was really shifting. And by the time I was a senior in high school, things were becoming political. Counterculture was beginning to emerge. And the idea of the liberated woman was starting to take hold of the culture. Women were expected to be sexually freer. They were no longer derided always for speaking their minds. And I say always because, in fact, you could still get in trouble for doing that, especially if you became involved in women's liberation, as it was then called. But there were kind of these warring ideals that kind of pulled at us. And I remember very, very well the struggle, you know, kind of being torn between these two ideals and trying to walk a line that managed to satisfy both of them. And I think a lot of women of my generation felt that.
I'm always curious about people who were in the feminist movement in that particular era, to ask how nuanced, in a sense, the message was at that point in time. Because, of course, the common perception was that it was a message that was antagonistic to a woman who might choose to be June Cleaver or Mrs. Brady or whoever,
right.
You know, and of course, chances are a lot of that just had to do with being confronted with such a revolutionary idea. And even if the actual content of the statements weren't directly critical of someone who for whatever reason might choose to live a more traditional life, the perception was at the time that not enough was said to acknowledge how such a life could be perfectly worthwhile, even if it's not what all women should have. But I wonder, as you look back now over all these decades, what your impression is of how the message in this particular way, generally speaking, mm-hmm. was shared at that point?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was a huge gap between what was actually going on within women's liberation movements and the way we were presented to the public. The way we were presented to the public via a largely male-dominated media, and which was not sympathetic to women's liberation at all, was that we were, you know, man-haters and we disdained women who stayed home. We were racist. We had a singular message. In fact, if you read the early writings from the women's liberation movement, though you find strains of that, for sure. I mean, there was a group called the Society for Cutting Up Men. You know, there are always extremist strains in any emerging political movement. But there equally were people writing articles like the Women's Liberation Movement is about the liberation of all people. One of the reasons I think, this is, you know, just my own analysis here, why I think, besides the fact that the media in general, as it often does, was going with the more provocative images, the reason why we got associated with slamming housewives was because at that time, a lot of what was going on was that those of us who had chosen to become housewives were meeting in groups and talking about the problems that we were facing, airing our own difficulties, and learning that they were not just our own, but they were much more widespread. You know, this is what is known as personal politics, the sudden revelation that, oh my gosh, if I felt that it wasn't enough for me to stay home with the kids and cook and clean, it isn't because I was a maladjusted person. I was being asked to do something that perhaps my own individual personality and talents were not inclined for. And maybe I need more. And those discoveries were not about other women. They weren't about trashing other women for choosing it. They were about understanding who we were as individuals and the way that we were being forced into a particular societal role. I know that that was very much my own revelation because, unlike Hillary, who stayed very active and political, never dropped out, I did drop out. You know, I found the situation in the 60s overwhelming, and I got into a marriage that was not good for me and was told by various psychologists that I was maladjusted to my female role as wife and that I just had to get used to it. Some of them put me on all kinds of crazy, you know, not very user-friendly drugs. And it was only by talking to other women in the women's liberation movement that I realized, well, wait a minute. I always used to write. You know, I was a great reader. I had fantasies of being a cultural critic. What happened to those? Well, you know, what happened to those? You know, I won't go into the whole personal biography, except to sum up and say that, you know, I was essentially taught by the culture and encouraged by my family to marry, and was not given encouragement for all those features of myself. So, to make a long story short, a lot of personal discoveries got translated by the press into generalizing comments about all women.
Hmm. And then, and in a sense, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, much of what you've talked about in terms of the shorthand way in which much of the media would speak about Hillary Clinton would gravitate to those kind of generalizations and simplifications that you believe ultimately did her a terrible disservice.
Yes. Yeah, it's really quite striking how, you know, there are certain archetypes, I guess you could call them, or images that are so much a part of our cultural heritage. There are racial ones, there are ethnic ones, and there are gendered ones. And they tend to get triggered in certain contexts. And I think that, you know, one of the points that Hillary makes and others had made about her before she made it is that, you know, when she was serving as Secretary of State or as Senator of New York, helping out the people whose lives had been damaged by 9/11, her approval ratings were sky high. When she stepped out of the role of pure service and ran for higher office, ran for president, that triggered, you know, a whole cultural undercurrent of suspicions and angers and discomfort with ambitious women. A lot of it is unconscious. You know, and a lot of it comes from women, too. You know, it isn't just men who were disturbed by the idea of a woman that ambitious. Mm. And I think that our own country, we have particular problems with this. You know, for historical reasons that are fascinating, you know, other countries do not seem to have as much a problem with strong, ambitious women as we do. Hmm. You know, for complicated reasons, we want women to be more feminine. At the same time, and this is where the double bind for women comes in, at the same time, if a woman is too soft or vulnerable or feminine, then she is seen as not having the power or the strength or the authority to achieve the highest office in the land, and sometimes even less than that. So there's this tightrope that women walk in our culture. I don't want to say it's around the world because every culture has its own heritage, but certainly in terms of the U.S., this business of being strong but without being strident, soft but without being a weak, vulnerable woman, it's a real hard tightrope to walk.
Right. You call it the dilemma of the female politician and devote a significant portion of your book to it. Let me reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Susan Bordeaux, who is the author of a most intriguing new book called The Destruction of Hillary Clinton. In this book, Susan Bordeaux examines what she believes to be some of the most significant factors that led to Hillary Clinton's rather shocking defeat at the hands of Donald Trump in the most recent presidential election. In the first part of that chapter called Dilemmas of the Female Politician, you have a whole section devoted to what you call the double bind. And I really think you are touching on something that is quite significant. Although I think most people would also say that it might be problematic for a male politician to actually tear up over a certain tragedy and also can sometimes do themselves a political disservice, at least, if they are not projecting the right kind of strength. But I think you are pointing to something absolutely legitimate when it comes to the typical female politician in terms of the choices that they have to make, very difficult choices in terms of what sort of personality to project. Explain how Hillary Clinton has had to wrestle with this dilemma throughout her public life.
I would love to, but I do want to also just preface it with a comment, because what you just said about men really, you know, sort of has made me think about mentioning the fact that, you know, men face their own double binds. And in another book that I've written a while back, I talk about the double binds that men face. I mean, each gender has got its own version of the double bind. You know, men have to be strong, but if they are too aggressive, then they are seen as kind of ferocious and animal-like. And, you know, so men have to tread a certain kind of tightrope themselves. Politicians, a little bit less so. I think that one of the things about, you mentioned men tearing up, and I think that, in fact, some of the most winning moments for male politicians have been when they teared up. Because it is seen in a different way. When a man tears up, we see it against the backdrop of expectations that he be emotionally more controlled. And so when he tears up, people's hearts go out to him. Now, I'm not saying if a man broke down, you know, crying uncontrollably, it wouldn't be a problem for him. But at one point, I remember Reagan teared up. And the press was just lavish in its praise, because their basic picture of Reagan was of this strong guy on a horse, right? And that a strong guy on a horse could cry was seen as a virtue, you know, rather than a liability. But Hillary, you know, Hillary has faced this problem in so many different ways, in so many different periods, because, of course, what we're talking about is a woman who's had this long career. And over the course of that career, ideas about women and the way women should behave have changed. So she's not only had to deal with that double bind of being, on the one hand, demonstrating enough strength to be president, but on the other hand, being soft enough so that she doesn't ruffle people's feathers, you know, about her lack of femininity. Ideas about women have changed a lot about that, and it's been really the challenge of accommodating to those different ideas. It is something. I sometimes wonder, for example, about Hillary's position on foreign affairs, and the degree to which she tends to take a stronger stand than perhaps many of her supporters would has to do with an age-old, in terms of her career, that is several decades old, need to show that she was tough. I remember when Geraldine Ferraro was running, you know, for vice president, she was constantly questioned, you know, do you think you'd be tough enough to push that button, right? And Hillary, as she is coming up, has to deal in some way with that stereotype of the woman who doesn't have the strength to push that button. And it may be part of the reason why, I don't want to call her a hawk, I don't like the image of a hawk, right? It may be part of the reason why her stance in terms of foreign affairs is stronger than, as I said before, some of her supporters might want it to be. You know, at the same time, of course, when she was Secretary of State, she did something that I think women do particularly well, which is to listen, to build a relationship, and she really did our country a tremendous service in altering our image around the world. So there's kind of two sides to Hillary in terms of her position within the context of international affairs. Her best side is in terms of diplomacy. She was a wonderful diplomat, and we certainly are lacking that right now. We could use a lot more of that right now. But she's also you know, even as she has employed those typically female traits, and I'm not saying they're only for women, she has also had to demonstrate her strengths. And then again, you know, when she was running against Obama in the primary, there was that key moment, and I talk about it in the book, when she teared up. And many people think that the fact that she went on to win after a defeat before to Obama, that she went on to win the New Hampshire primary, was because she teared up. Because at that moment, a lot of people saw, oh, she's a woman after all. You know, she's got a heart. Why they would have thought she didn't have a heart, God only knows. You know, at that moment, she became more of what people expected for women. On the other hand, if she had done that during a debate, you can be sure that people would have talked about her not having the strength or fortitude to stand up to things.
In the second chapter of your book, you talk about this thing that came to be known as the woman card, and you titled the chapter, "The Woman Card Moves to the Bottom of the Deck." And what you are alluding to, of course, here is the really tricky matter that Hillary Clinton and her campaign staff faced, namely how much to, in a sense, play that women card. Although I'm quoting Mr. Trump there, of course, who who used that in really derogatory fashion. But just explain the kind of choices that confronted Hillary Clinton in terms of how directly to address matters of gender and the fact that she was a woman, that she would be the first woman president, and to what extent you think she and her staff ultimately made the right choices in that respect.
It's hard to know about those choices because, of course, you're dealing with many different groups of potential voters, and they receive these things in different ways. But I do know that the very idea that it's a woman card, that wasn't something we really saw very much in the 2012 election. And it's a misstatement of what one does when one works for issues that affect women and their families, you know, like reproductive rights, health care, equal pay for equal work. The idea that that's playing a woman card, you know, suggests that it's exploiting an unfair advantage in some way. That and Trump had a lot to do with turning the advocacy for women's issues into this thing called playing the woman card. It's equivalent to like playing the race card. In other words, it came to be thought of as asking people to vote for you just because historically there had been no woman and now it was my turn, right? That's what the woman card came to be seen as. And Hillary's never running on that card. You know, she never ran on the idea, vote for me because I am a woman. Certainly it was a very appealing thing to many women and many men as well for us to have our first woman president. But this was an extraordinary, accomplished, experienced person who certainly did not base her campaign on the fact that she was a woman.
Right.
And yet that was continually being thrown at her. Now, you know, it's a tricky thing because during the campaign against Obama, she really downplayed her gender, possibly even more than she needed to. In this campaign, it was much trickier to talk about gender because there's was so much backlash against the idea of women running as women. And there was so much in the air about political correctness. You know, we had, you know, I do a lot of comparison of the, in the book, comparing, contrasting the 2012 election to this election. In the 2012 election, women's issues were really in the air. People were talking about assaults on reproductive rights all the time, and several politicians, Aiken and the other guy's name has just gone right out of my head, who said that not Aiken, who said that you can't get pregnant if you're raped, but the politician who said that even, you know, a child from rape was a blessing from God. I've just forgotten his name for the moment. People lost elections because they said really insulting, abusive things about women. We didn't hear much of that in this election. Reproductive issues were barely talked about. And partly that was because what was in the air was this idea that this is the species of political correctness, right? This is just, you know, more of the business of playing the one card. And it's too bad because I think that especially a younger generation of women, don't mean to be condescending to them. I'm just describing a historical difference, that they had the misleading sense. They got the misleading sense under Obama, who was very much a supporter of reproductive rights and who is, I believe, a true feminist, that it was all okay. You know, that was taken care of. We didn't have to worry about that. And in fact, as you know now, as we all know now, we did very much have to worry about it because those things are under siege. And the fact that the day after Trump's inauguration, we saw this massive emergence of demonstrations all over the globe focusing on many issues, but among them reproductive rights, all the and the various women's issues that had gotten really submerged during the election. I would say not just submerged, but actually smashed down by Trump. But they also were not signature items in Bernie's campaign. And when Bernie talked about the working class, he didn't really address women as part of the working class. And so that there were a number of ways in which women's issues never did come to the forefront until after we elected someone who was putting them in jeopardy.
Right. I thought it was interesting in your book, in the chapter about playing the women's card and so on, that that when Hillary Clinton came up with this very effective rejoinder, well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay for women is playing the women card, then deal me in. I mean, the applause broke the ceiling off the building. I mean, that was very well received, and it was a line that she used then again and again and again.
Too many times.
I mean, and that's something you say right out, that for as effective as that was the first time she said it, you really found yourself wincing every time she was about to say it and would sort of pray silently, please don't say that line again. Please don't say that line again.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is how I felt. I really wanted her to do some other things in response to the idea of the woman card. The deal me in worked, you know, the first time, but it became almost, you know, a kind of reminder of what many young women thought of as a stale feminism. You know, this is like feminism based upon sisterhood and solidarity and a lot of things that no longer had the freshness that they once had. What I really wanted her to do was to say at one point, the woman card, huh? Well, what about the man card? Don't you think that's been dealt quite a bit during this election? You know, what about when you criticized, you know, so-and-so for being little Marco and he came back talking about the size of your hands? Did that have something to do with playing the man card? So I would have liked her to have turned it around. Of course, you know, I'm speaking as a writer. I'm not on, you know, the public stage having to come up with these things at the moment. But boy, would I love to have seen that.
Right.
Or for her to have done a version of what Reagan did so effectively, you know, the there you go again.
Right. That.
You know, how many times do I have to hear this business? The woman card.
Right.
Those would for me have been very effective in ways that simply repeating deal me in ceased to be after a while.
Right. You have very critical things to say about Bernie Sanders, and I suspect that a lot of people will be talking about some of what you say in your third chapter as much as they talk about anything in the book. And it's important that you do say there are plenty of ways in which you and Mr. Sanders are politically aligned with one another, not in every respect, but in many, many respects. But you write, as much as I am in agreement with many of his ideas, Bernie Sanders splintered and ultimately sabotaged the Democratic Party, not because he chose to run against Hillary Clinton, but because of how he ran against her. And I think chief among your charges is that you deeply resent the way in which Bernie Sanders managed to brand Hillary Clinton as part of the establishment. Mm-hmm. Tell us, first of all, how he did that and the extent to which you believe that not to be true, or at least not true in the way that he framed the charge.
Right. And I'm glad that you said in the way he framed the charge, because, of course, both Hillary and Bernie are part of the establishment. You know, Bernie, appearances to the contrary, is not a labor organizer. He was a senator. And, you know, so they both worked within, you know, established government boundaries and were progressive in some issues and not so progressive on others. I mean, she outshone him in a lot of areas. He was stronger in other areas. And yet he managed to galvanize a following around the notion that only he was the true progressive, and that she was merely a tool of Wall Street. For sure, Hillary is establishment in many ways. I mean, she's a politician who has operated within our political system, as is Bernie Sanders. But she has, throughout her career, also fought for many progressive causes. And for her to be simply identified with Wall Street, I mean, lots of her, his followers came to see her as a harlot of Wall Street. She's in the pocket of Wall Street. She's a tool of Wall Street. Often on the basis of the fact that she had delivered speeches to Goldman Sachs. I mean, you know, this is that she had delivered speeches in which she might have said a few complimentary things at the beginning. You know, I am someone who goes to colleges and gives talks. I always begin by thanking the people who have invited me, by saying a few nice words to them, and then I go on to say what I have to say. And Hillary, throughout her career, has been someone who has tried to do what she can as a progressive, knowing that we live in a country in which compromises, listening to the other, finding a place of common ground, and working from there is necessary. So she's been what she would describe as a pragmatic progressive. Bernie replied essentially by saying, and I'm not talking in a direct quote here, by saying, anyone who does not see the critique of Wall Street as at the center of everything cannot call herself a progressive. Anyone who delivers highly paid speeches to Goldman Sachs cannot call herself a progressive. Bernie even said that NARAL and Planned Parenthood were establishment because, well, I'm not quite sure why because, but, you know, it's clear that he had a very particular pure left, let's call it the pure left idea of what it means to be establishment.
And, of course, he, perhaps even without realizing it, was feeding a prevailing sense throughout so much of the population on both sides of the aisle about resentment towards the establishment and perhaps exactly. was damaging Hillary Clinton even more than he realized. You also are really critical of Bernie Sanders for being, in a sense, as tepid in his support of Hillary Clinton as he was when he ultimately withdrew from the race. You feel like the choices he made in terms of the issues for which he was willing to praise Hillary Clinton were a rather limp list of many issues that are typically associated with women and so on. I mean, you feel like in that way, he also did her a real disservice.
Yeah. Yeah, I really saw change in Bernie Sanders throughout the campaign. At the beginning, you know, I as you mentioned, I share many ideas in common with him. I may not agree with him about the possibility of reaching them within our own culture right now, but I applauded a lot of what he said. I liked him. I appreciated his politics. As the campaign went on, and as he began to develop this following, who I think fed or, I don't know exactly how to describe it, fed his constructing himself in complete antagonism to Hillary Clinton, he became more and more encouraging of the extreme elements within his supporters, those people who went on to become Bernie or Busters. You know, I think of the Bernie Sanders supporters as falling roughly into two groups, those who understood the policy issues and who supported him, but who did not see Hillary Clinton as a witch or the harlot of Wall Street, and who once she won the nomination went on to support her. And then there are those who were bringing the signs to the rallies, you know, Monsanto Mama, and who saw her as the lesser of two evils, and who even continue now. I mean, there's been a huge Twitter campaign against my book because of my criticisms of Bernie Sanders' campaign to talk about, you know, bitch and traitress, and she caused the, you know, she's the reason why Trump was elected, and really vicious, nasty stuff. What I criticize Bernie for is he never tamped them down. You know, as he saw this happening in his campaign, as he saw the misogynist extremists come to the fore, the Bernie bros, as he saw the signs which declared her a witch and a bitch, as he saw, you know, people like Susan Sarandon say that she was more dangerous than Trump, you know, the kind of stuff that was coming out, he needed to have done something akin to what John McCain did, you know, when he told that, you know, Islamophobic, wait a minute, you know, Barack Obama is a good, decent man. He never did that. He started out doing that, but that changed. And as the rhetoric was ratcheted up against Hillary, he did nothing to damp it down. Then, as it became inevitable that she was going to win, and as others began and when she did win, and as others began to endorse her, it took him forever to do it. At the Democratic convention, he sat there grumpy and growling, you know, as though it just caused him enormous pain to have to endorse this woman. And in fact, when he finally endorsed her, as you said very eloquently, he did it in an awfully tepid fashion. In contrast, for example, to Hillary and Barack. I mean, the Sanders supporters often point out that Hillary hung on till the bitter end. She did. But then once she gave up, she put her whole heart and soul into getting him elected.
And, of course, a really powerful moment in the Democratic convention was when none other than Michelle Obama acknowledged that, the fact that,
exactly.
that Hillary Clinton had been as gracious and forthright a supporter of Barack Obama as she was. And those words coming especially from Michelle Obama herself, I thought were especially powerful and effective.
Very powerful. Very powerful.
A couple other things we need to talk about before we're out of time. And one of them is the chapter you devote to the matter of of Hillary Clinton being untrustworthy. And you find this to be, for the most part, at least a ludicrous charge. You believe her to be, of all the major candidates we heard from through this campaign, according to the fact checkers, at least, she would have been the most truthful of them all. Later in the chapter, you point out a very interesting study that was done by the NYU Stern School of Business that found that women in power in general are seen as less trustworthy than men in the same position. I had not seen that study before. I found it fascinating and disturbing. I wonder if you have any ideas about what possibly could be behind that. I mean, what is going on that a woman in power is not trusted the same way a man might be trusted?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, it's one that the answer has to be very layered. And we don't have the time for me to go into all the layers of it.
Right.
But, I mean, you could devote a course to that. But there are, to begin with, and this is something that, you know, is one of the most enduring factors. We have so many archetypes, you know, from Eve and the apple, right, to Helen of Troy, you know, that have the legacy of imagery of the woman who deceives and dissembles and manipulates. The woman who was the center of my last book, Anne Boleyn, she acquired enormous reputation over the years, and it continues to today, for being a deceptive manipulator. When you examine the facts of the matter, it doesn't really turn out to be that. But those charges don't really hold up very well. So there's a kind of, you know, a historical backlog of ideas. We saw it with Anita Hill, too. And, my God, that was unfair. You know, the idea that she was, you know, this, you know, lying, manipulative, scheming, you know, with political motives that were hidden. The idea that women hide things, you know, that we're kind of deceivers. This is part of our cultural treasure trove of ideas about women. And in the case of Clinton, you see, it gets then layered with notions that we have about the Clintons as a couple, you know, because often they got merged in the public imagination. He lied, so therefore she lies. And the notion that she often covered up his lies began to be pretty prominent, first among right-wing circles, and then, you know, you started to hear even on mainstream TV the notion that she was an enabler, you know, that she had, she would cover up, in exchange for the power that Bill allowed her to gain entry to, she would cover up Bill's affairs. You know, this is just a standard theme of the right-wing hate books. So she got also saddled with that. And then, of course, there were the particulars of this election. And, you know, I do go into a lot of detail in the book. It was very important to me to follow the various charges about her lies to see whether any of them held up. The email scandal, for example, few people know that Clinton did not lie, nor did she even treat her classified material recklessly. We don't know that because the press, rather than highlight those moments when her truthfulness was in fact revealed, and they were there, I hope people read my chapter and read it carefully. They highlighted those moments when, looks like she's hiding something, or why doesn't she come clean? Or we saw that during the pneumonia episode. What's she really suffering from? Is it Parkinson's? Is it AIDS? You know, has she got brain damage? The press began with this frame, this narrative of Hillary as part of this Clinton mega establishment that was constantly shielding itself from public view. In part, she contributed to it. I'm not blaming her for it, which a lot of people do. She contributed to it because over the years she became quite cautious with the press. You know, when they asked her questions, she knew that inevitably things were going to get taken out of context. And hard to talk about complicated things like that email system. She tried, but they were constantly headlining the stuff that was most sensational and that reinforced this narrative of untrustworthy Hillary. It was much more exciting, of course, than the narrative of, oh my gosh, you know, she's really a pretty responsible politician and she doesn't lie very much. Untrustworthy Hillary was just a gripping story, and there was always a new chapter to add to it.
And do you think
it helped? I'm sorry.
And do you think that's the main motivation? If in fact the media ultimately portrayed her in much more negative terms than you think she warranted, was it a conscious or unconscious gravitation towards, in a sense, salacious headlines that would grab a lot of attention? I mean, is that what this ultimately is about in terms of the media's role in all this?
Well, I think it's complicated with the media. It's a great question, Greg, because I think that the media has had a lot of resentment at Hillary for being cautious with them and from not always, you know, having tons of press conferences. And it's built up over the years. But there is a certain degree of resentment. There was resentment against her that I saw just leaking out all over the place. But then, too, there was this change in reporting, which is that reporters started to focus on the excitement that they could generate over optics, what things seem to be like, the appearance of impropriety, rather than holding back on those provocative optics until things were thoroughly investigated. And the right wing was constantly feeding the media with these provocative, suspect things about Clinton. So, you know, I don't want to say this is all the media. I think that we had a very effective GOP propaganda machine that would, I mean, the emails are a perfect example. You know, you start out with the GOP grabbing onto a series of things that, I mean, you know, I'm not going to rehearse the whole thing because it would take us way beyond our time. But the GOP grabs onto a few things, throws it like red meat to the media, starts to conduct an investigation, which right away becomes breaking news. You know, as soon as you conduct an investigation, well, of course, something probably is going on there. Where there's smoke, there's fire. And the media, you know, it's competitive media. And the news media are often on 24 hours a day. And they're very conscious of the need to keep up with what's coming out, you know, to have the scoop. And I think there's a certain kind of breathless rush that now characterizes reporting that has made them very susceptible to fake news of various sorts and, you know, news that may not even be quite fake in the sense of National Enquirer, but suspect optics that are presented by, you know, an opponent than they used to be.
It is so interesting, and again, points to the picture that you had of the so-called secret storm of all of these different factors at play, including certain factors in which we're talking about people who were almost certainly not consciously hoping for Hillary Clinton to be defeated or in any way actively working towards her defeat, although there's plenty of people on the other hand who were.
Right.
But in a
right.
sense, you combine the concerted efforts of those who vehemently opposed her, combine that with, in a sense, the inadvertent help they received.
Exactly.
And we begin to understand how it was that she went down to defeat.
Exactly. And then, of course, you'll throw in Comey.
Right. We've not even touched on that, because
it's a whole other subject. But I think the way you put it is really well put. You had conscious deliberation.